This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/radio3.
In the floodplain of the River Bain in Lincolnshire, not far from the boundary between the two ancient territories of Lindsey and Kesteven, an unusual burial was discovered in 1981. Sometime around the years 660 to 670, a man was buried in this lonely spot, near a place known nowadays as Tattershall Thorpe. The grave is close to what must have been the first point for a safe landing above the meeting point of the navigable rivers, the Witham and the Bain. This is a remote, marginal spot on the fen edge, a place of water and sky, and it gives no clue as to why this man was buried here, far from the nearest known Anglo-Saxon cemetery. But his belongings, some or all of which were buried with him, tell an intriguing story. Laid alongside the dead man, the excavators found an array of iron tools. They included three hammers of different sizes, a small anvil, tongs, snips, a draw plate for making iron wire or nails, punches, knives, files and gravers of various kinds, and soldering equipment, all of it carefully tied up in bundles. There were also at least four wooden boxes of metal scrap, including iron rods and bars, copper alloy melts, and neatly folded fragments of sheet, oddments of lead, and a few small silver offcuts. In one of these boxes were half a dozen shaped garnets, ready for inlaying in jewellery, and the base of a thicker blue glass beaker, perhaps also for making inlays, or for melting down to make beads. More exotic scrap objects included a Frankish copper alloy box fitting and rivets from a knife sheath. Minute traces of gold found on one or two of the objects confirmed that the man also worked with precious metals. And for weighing these, he had a Byzantine bronze weight and some Roman coins also adapted as weights, along with a set of scales. By comparison, his personal equipment was minimal, a belt buckle and an enigmatic iron bell. The individual that we encounter here in his lonely grave was not, to judge from the personal possessions buried with him, a particularly rich man. But the tools of his trade tell us that he was a smith, who worked with iron and with non-ferrous metals and gems, and as such he would have had a distinctive status. Smiths in Anglo-Saxon tradition were certainly special. In legend and in real life, they were cultivated by kings for their skills in working iron into superb weapons and armour and in fashioning magnificent gem-set jewellery, like that from the Great Sutton Hoo ship burial. The legendary smith Wayland is credited with making many famous swords, not to mention the mail coat worn by Beowulf. The story goes that his work was so prized that he was captured, lamed and imprisoned by the evil King Nithhad, so that he could produce splendid jewellery and fine metalwork for the king and his family. Despite his skills and his fame, the smith was enslaved. In time, he exacted a terrible revenge by killing the king's sons and raping his daughter, and he escaped on wings of his own making. This was a clever and dangerous hero. Wayland is celebrated in several Anglo-Saxon poems and portrayed on a number of contemporary stone crosses. Indeed, so elevated was the status of this mythic smith and so powerful his story that he's actually depicted side by side with a representation of the Adoration of the Magi on the front of the famous 8th century whalebone box known as the Frank's Casket. Even King Alfred contrived to insert a mention of the smith into his translation of Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy. Where, wrote Alfred, are the bones of Wayland now? And who knows now where they might be? Wayland's prowess as both blacksmith and goldsmith was probably rarer in real life, where the two roles became increasingly separate, though there were always exceptions. The will of the Atheling Athelstan, written in 1015, refers to a silver-hilted sword and a gold belt and armlet, all made by a smith named Wulfric. And traditionally, St Dunstan, abbot of Glastonbury and later Archbishop of Canterbury, who died in 988, is said to have excelled as a metal worker. He famously once tweaked the devil's nose with his red-hot tongs. That's a lively piece of hagiographical invention, of course, but as a monk, Dunstan would certainly have had the opportunity to learn both crafts within the largely self-sustaining monastic community. Our Lincolnshire smith certainly seems to have worked with both iron and precious metals. When we explore these two aspects of the smith's work, the special status of the craft implied by the Wayland legend becomes very clear. The blacksmith's transformation of raw iron in the heat and clangour of the smithy was a dangerous and almost magical process which set him physically apart from other crafts. In Abbot Elfrich of Aynsham's Colloquy, a late 10th century Latin schoolbook, the speaker complains about the din of hammers banging, the blustering of the bellows and the iron sparks. This was noisy and hazardous work. The risks from the furnace and its sparks to thatched or shingled wooden buildings meant that the smith normally worked well away from houses, but his craft put him at the heart of the community because everyone needed his products. As the smith in Elfrich's Colloquy explains, "Where does the ploughman get his ploughshare, or coulter, or goad, except by my craft? Where does the fisherman get his hook, or the shoemaker his awl, or the tailor his needle?" Ironwork underpinned the life and work of the community, in the form of all the everyday iron equipment, from nails and knives and door hinges to horse gear and intricate wrought iron suspension chains for cauldrons, like the one that hung in the great hall of the king buried at Sutton Hoo. The iron to make these products came from deposits of ironstone and bog ore, and excavations of Anglo-Saxon smelting sites have shown that it was mostly produced in quite simple furnaces and in relatively small quantities. And with rare exceptions, smelting seems to have been kept separate from smithing, so iron must have been transported at some distance to the forge. The parcels of iron rods, sheet and bars buried with our Tattershall smith represent some of his carefully hoarded stock of raw material. Weapons were amongst the most spectacular and technically accomplished products of the smith. The old English poem known as The Gifts of Men neatly sums this up. "A cunning smith can make many weapons for use in war when he forges a helmet or a sax or a mail coat, a shining blade or a round shield firmly fixed against the spear's flight." The smith knew how to use differing iron compositions to produce good cutting edges, resilience and flexibility. Most famous were pattern-welded sword blades, constructed from rods which were repeatedly twisted together and reforged in many sequences to produce an intricately woven, damascened effect, which was aptly described by the Beowulf poet as Wyrmfach, decorated with snakes. Such swords were highly prized, and some, like the sword Hrunting in Beowulf, were even given their own names, as if they had their own personalities. There's also evidence that some famous swords were passed down from generation to generation. In his will of 1015, the Etheling Æthelstan bequeathed to his brother Edmund the precious sword which had belonged to King Offa, an heirloom that would have been well over 200 years old at the time of the bequest. Some of these sword blades, and the long single-edged weapons known as saxes, conspicuously bore the name of their maker, rather than that of the owner, as a guarantee of quality. On one, the name of the maker is actually far larger than that of the owner. Many were intricately decorated. A huge 10th-century sax blade, dredged from the River Thames, is inlaid with the 28 letters of the runic alphabet, constructed from silver and copper wires, and probably intended as a charm to protect the bearer. A few maker inscriptions on objects made in other metals, copper alloys and pewter, as well as precious metals, also proclaim the smith's reputation, giving fleeting glimpses of the individuals behind some of the more ambitious pieces. A wonderful 10th-century cast bronze openwork structure in the form of a church tower, which was possibly part of a grand censer, is inscribed, "Godrich made me." But not all smiths were equal, as is rather poignantly revealed in an inscription on a gold and garnet inlaid brooch from a late 7th-century woman's grave in Norfolk. Its front is disfigured by a coarse and incompetent repair, but on its back, the inscription, "Luda repaired this brooch," proudly immortalises the botched attempt. In another class altogether are the smiths who made the virtuoso gold and garnet inlaid jewellery from the Sutton Hoo ship burial, and the extraordinary assemblage of richly decorated silver and gold war gear from the hoard of battle booty recently found in South Staffordshire. These magnificent products of 7th century goldsmiths buried only a few decades before the less exalted Smith buried at Tattershall Thorpe, are unrivalled anywhere else in early medieval Europe. Their makers must have been amongst a handful of celebrity smiths who, like Wayland, were greatly sought after. Yet not only do we not know their identities, we know almost nothing of how the production of such fine metalwork was organised. The quality of the finest jewellery suggests that kings at this time were able to attract the greatest goldsmiths of the age. Two centuries later, King Alfred's biographer Asser tells us that the king commissioned major pieces of precious metalwork, such as the gold, crystal and enamelled Alfred jewel, which is framed by an inscription proclaiming, "Alfred commanded me to be made." Alfred also imported many goldsmiths from abroad to his court to create wonderful new treasures to his own designs. The patronage of Anglo-Saxon nobles was clearly important too. The Gifts of Men tells us that a smith is subtly skilled in gold and gems when a protector of men, that is a lord, orders him to set a jewel with splendour. This fits the picture of fine metalwork that we get from the wills of the late Anglo-Saxon aristocracy and churchmen and from Alfred's commissions. But what are we to make of a hoard of fine early 9th century silver disc brooches where five are in mint condition, including two pairs? This looks much more like the kind of jeweller's hoard we're familiar with in the later Middle Ages, made not to order but for sale. And for less grand jewellery, we can only speculate. Our smith at Tattershall Thorpe was probably making and repairing jewellery and other metalwork to order, though the numbers of brooches which use related or identical models suggest that there were also workshops producing in greater quantities, at least towards the end of the period. The non-ferrous metals used by these master craftsmen were almost entirely recycled from existing artefacts, which came from a variety of sources. Copper alloys, bronze and brass, were cannibalised from Roman and later objects, including coins. Gold was mainly sourced in the form of Byzantine coins and became increasingly scarce after those supplies dried up in the first quarter of the 7th century. There's no direct evidence for silver mining during the Anglo-Saxon period, though lead was extracted. The main source was late Roman silver, and later on bullion and coins which flooded into Western Europe on the back of Viking adventures in the Near East. The bronze and other scraps so carefully hoarded by our smith graphically reveal how important recycling was when the sources were often scarce and unreliable. In fact, a smith's life was not always a secure one. The man buried in the lonely grave at Tattershall Thorpe doesn't have the trappings of a wealthy individual, and his incomplete and rather tatty assemblage of equipment might indicate that he'd seen better days. The marginal location of the burial suggests that he was considered to be in some way set apart from the local community, maybe even unsafe. Was he a stranger, an itinerant smith who happened to have died on his travels, or whilst in the temporary service of a local lord? The bell among his possessions could hint at such a scenario, since a bell could be rung by a lone traveller to signal that he wasn't a threat. As an outsider, and especially one whose craft involved the quasi-magical transformation of metals and its attendant dangers, perhaps the locals considered it prudent to bury him at a safe distance from their community. We'll never know for certain why the Tattershall Thorpe smith was buried in this unusual manner. He remains an enigma, which, in a way, sums up the ambiguity of the smith's role implied in the legend of Wayland. He might serve a master, yet he possesses special powers. He's essential to the community, and his workmanship is prized, but he also represents danger, and his mysterious skills set him apart, even at Tattershall Thorpe in death.